Well, first of all, just say it's a real pleasure to be here. It's 25 years since I was last in San Francisco and I wasn't at the Buddhist Center there on that occasion. So, yeah, it's lovely to be here. So I'm going to talk a bit about mindfulness and various sort of health-related issues. The short title is Mindfulness for Just About Everything, which kind of sums it up. Certainly in the UK, there's been a whole great surge of interest in mindfulness, although I suspect actually we might be a bit behind the US, because I think over here there's been a longer history of interest in mindfulness for health-related issues. And in the UK, it's been taken up very widely for stress, pain, anxiety, depression, personality disorder, and for addiction. And we've been running courses at our centre in London for the last 2 years. So what I wanted to do in this talk was really have a look at this phenomenon of mindfulness and how it's applied to various health-related conditions, and particularly look at its relationship to the Buddhist tradition. In other words, where it comes out of, how it relates to the Buddhist tradition. So over the weekend, those of you coming on the weekend, that'll be much more practical. So this is more of a, if you like, a conceptual background to mindfulness for health-related conditions, and as I said, where it comes out of the Buddhist tradition. So I'm going to start with a bit of therapeutic history, as it were, of meditation and Buddhism. And this is not comprehensive, but I just want to draw out a few strands. Starting with meditation, first became popular in the West in the 1960s, when initially it was seen as something of a cure-all. And people started doing studies in the 70s and 80s on meditation, and particularly meditation with an emphasis on concentration and relaxation, particularly a lot of transcendental meditation studies. And these early studies showed that TM was beneficial for anxiety, for high blood pressure, for cannabis, and for general well-being. There were some problems, though, with these early studies, which, when you did a comparison, it showed that actually wasn't much difference between just sitting quietly or other forms of relaxation. So in other words, although there was some benefit, it wasn't very specific to the meditation. Then there was another strand which looked at the Buddhist suttas and looked at how the Buddha behaved as a therapist. Somebody looked at how you could see him in effect of doing behaviour therapy. So there's a couple of stories to give you examples of this. So the story of a particular king, and this king had a problem. He had a problem that he slept a lot and he couldn't get up, and eventually got so bad that he, well, I was going to say went to see the Buddha, but of course he couldn't go to see the Buddha because he couldn't get up. But he got the Buddha to come and see him, and the Buddha diagnosed his problem with overeating, which of course, you know, with the modern epidemic of obesity, is, you know, relevant today perhaps. Anyway, what the Buddha did is he gave a little prescription for the king, which was that when he was served his food, he wasn't allowed to eat the last mouthful. And he was supervised by the prince, and when the prince was supervising this, just if the king was going to, you know, elbow in and get that last mouthful, the Buddha gave him a verse to remind him of why he was not to have that last mouthful. And so each day he had a little bit less food, and in time he, of course, became lean and healthy, and he had no problems with sleep, and he could get up. So, seen from a modern point of view, that would be a bit of behaviour therapy to do that. So, examine the behaviour, diagnose the behavioural problem, and gave a treatment. There's another one, which is probably a better well-known story, which is the story of Kisa Gotami. So, Kisa Gotami suffered from what we might think of today as a pathological grief reaction. She was a lady who'd had quite a difficult background. She became married, and in those days in India, when you married, if you went to the husband's family, and as a woman, you were kind of the bottom of the pile, you were a bit of a skivvy who was pushed about. That is, until you gave birth to a child, and particularly if the child was a son, then your social status raised. So she gave birth to a son, and she was very happy, and of course very attached to her son. Unfortunately, when her son wasn't very old, he died. One account says he was bitten by a snake. And she was grief-struck. She just couldn't believe that this had happened to her. And she went round, not believing that her baby was dead, asking people for medicine for her baby to make him well again. And eventually someone said, go and see the Buddha. And the Buddha said, yes, I can give you medicine for your baby. And the medicine is a mustard seed. However, the mustard seed must come from a house where nobody has died. So Chisa Goten was very happy. She went rushing off. And she went to house after house after house. Everywhere people were very happy to give her a mustard seed, but each house she came to, an uncle had died, a daughter had died, a husband had died, somebody had died. And eventually she realised, of course, that death happens. It's inevitable. And she realised her own son was, of course, dead, couldn't be brought back to life. And she became a disciple of the Buddha and, according to tradition, became enlightened. So, again, just coming from our particular perspective, again, you could see that as a behavioural experiment, which in this case was very efficacious for Kisa Gotami understanding what was going on. There's been a whole line of thought, as I said, like this, in terms of looking at the suttas, in terms of the Buddha acting as a behaviour therapist, and it's been suggested that particularly if you're working with people from an ethnic Buddhist background, that could be quite useful. I haven't seen anybody who's then actually really applied it in another way to Westerners, but it's an interesting line of thought.